Well, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
Look, I don't have to do this.
You don't have any choice.
I'm trying to help you people. Now, why won't you accept that?
It's in our DNA. You have to do what old man says.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, Ray.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Bluewater, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Grandfather, teach me the ways of the old, so that I may remember who I am.
Osio, Keenly, who I am is Will Bluewater, and our guest this evening is John Palmer. John was born and raised in Australia and was guided into the Red Road after a near-death experience called him to heal the wounds left by alcohol abuse. He has worked closely with elders and indigenous medicine people from many nations, including Aboriginal, American Indian, and Siberian shamanic people. John's also a sun dancer. He, along with his wife Judy, are currently organizers of spiritual gatherings through Spiritual Unity of the Tribes Australia, a nonprofit organization that honors the vision of Black Elk Lakota Holy Man, which is to mend the sacred hoop of humanity by bringing together all nations of the world through sharing and understanding in order to live peacefully together as one united family. John is a counselor, healer, musician, and hypnotherapist, assisting people in rediscovery of their spiritual essence
And John, we welcome you to the show. Your mic is live. Say hello, Mark, or John and Mark.
Yeah, hi. It's John. Yeah. Glad to be here.
And Mark Borcherding is our co-host. And before we get rolling, we'd like to do a Mayan birth reading on our guests. And it really gives us something to talk about and spurs conversation. So take it away, Mark.
Well, in the traditional Mayan day count, he was born on a day 13 Simi, which is the last day of the Jaguar cycle. So he may have some Jaguar stuff showing up in his life sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Simi is a glyph that's also called the skull or the death glyph. So it has to do with not just death, but in the Mesoamerican cultures, they looked at death as a death and a rebirth. So the way they looked at it was death was the seed of life.
Near-death experience.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah. And so what that may indicate is that things to look for maybe perhaps in a near-death, because a good percentage of people that come up with this glyph tend to have near-death experiences or some other, you know, connection with death or out of body or something like that. The number 13 on it is the final day of the cycle, and it also kind of relates to the base energy of a pyramid, where the pyramid connects into the earth. And with the Simi and that pyramid energy, the concept of transmutation of things, of even reality itself. The Simi part also brings about a little bit about the connection of knowledge of elders and things, and also the bridging, like not just near death, but a communication across what we would call the veil or dimensions or whatever, you know, you want to choose to call it. It's a white glyph, so it's going to relate to the direction of the north. So we'll look now at the sixth sun, Sulcan, and see what it is. And it's going to have three readings on it, a forward and backward flow of time, or the two time flows could come together in a unity or a balance. So we'll start with the forward flow of time, the way we normally, our senses perceive time. And on yours, it's all about, this is going from birth going forward, or even slightly before birth, possibly. Yours is all about purpose, discipline, dimensionality, creator, harmony, stuff like that, trusting your heart, the green color, so it's heart chakra color energy. Also has a lot of connection into light. So a lot really about basically kind of the purpose of things, doing what needs to be done, and connecting with creator on that. So you probably had above normal ability or desire to do that throughout life. Now on the backward flow, we have that 13 Simi that we just talked about coming up again. But it's on the backward flow of time, so it's in more in the future coming back. So it's kind of interesting. This happens sometimes, but not real often, that we have a match across Zulkins like that. So it's on this one, it's showing a little bit more about it, what's happened in recent years, maybe around 1998, 97, somewhere a little bit before or after then. And it's again about transformation and such, but it's bringing in an aspect of here of learning how to, like the Aborigines in Australia said, we're just beginning to learn how to live in eternity.
Uh-huh.
Or dream time.
Yeah.
And it is, it's also bringing in an aspect where the thing about peace, it's the 13th day of the peace cycle. So the peace part of it's probably become here in recent years probably more prevalent and bigger thing, and something that you're probably a lot more willing to make sacrifices towards that, and tuning in, and tuning into it, and maybe help other people tuning into it as well. Now where these two flow, time flows come together, they're a Tekpatl or Etzanab glyph, and it's all about how things are ordered, and light, and especially mirroring. So you may have gotten a lot of lessons or things showing up that teach you or help you with others too as well, because as you learn about it and then help others on their path, things that have to do with the reflections and mirroring of things. And it's got a big component here of the idea of sacrificing eternity again, but also love as a primary thing here. And it's bringing in the ability, probably if you tap into your thing with your near-death experience before, of moving outside of time. More of mystical things, mystical abilities, and not just thinking, but all that. So, and it's all this thing about moving outside in time, mystical things. What I would look for, a key thing would be look for things that are a jaguar or jaguar-like animal, totem animal, showing up in your dreams or whatever. That will be something, or maybe even an elder, the ancestor that had some kind of jaguar connection. Look for that, because that'll probably be a big thing that will help you on the idea of moving outside of time and the mystical aspects. That's going to be the jaguar connection there will be very important. And how to, this will all lead to bringing this into action. It'll be bringing it, literally kind of bringing it down to earth and making things actually happen. And another one to look a little bit for, too, is serpent or snake, in the Mayan Chacon type energy, or Quetzal and the Quetzalcoatl, the Quetzal part. That aspect, and it's a red glyph. So it will tie in probably your whole thing with the red robe. Something there may show up. So you got kind of jaguar and serpent things here showing up. This particular glyph is also white. So you got a lot of white glyphs here, mainly white and green, a little bit of red, but mainly white and green. So the center is green, and then the white would be the direction of the north. And that's many of the medicine wheels, the north is a lot of times this direction of ancestors, too.
Yes.
So.
Okay.
I would look for kind of ancestors sitting on the sidelines showing up. May not be obvious, but they're there.
Okay.
They may sometimes they give you a kick in the butt, and sometimes they're just kind of sitting there, and you kind of have to figure it out yourself. It depends on.
Yeah, I had a couple of those.
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, that's pretty much it.
Thank you so much.
Well,
for that.
Don, what do you think about all that, and now that you've heard that, how do you think it what's the word I'm looking for? There is a word I can't find it right now. Brain fart. how do you think that works in light of what you've been doing?
It is so accurate. It's scary. Yeah.
It usually is.
It's right on the money there. I've had an interest in the Mayan calendar for a while also, and I'm really blown away by how accurate that is with what's happened within my life up until now, and it's pretty much right on everything that's going on with me, even up to now, and the near-death experience, and also the other aspects of things I'm working towards. So, yes, it certainly ties in, and I'll have to keep my eyes out for the jaguar showing up, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, take us back to when you were on that alcohol road and what happened, and you know, tell us what happened.
Okay, I'll tell you. I'll start the story from the beginning. I guess that's the best place. So, I found myself in the grips of alcohol over a period of a long period of time, probably from my late 20s. I started seriously drinking a lot more. I was working as an accountant in a bank in Australia at that time, and
no wonder.
yeah, that's enough to drive anyone to drink, yeah. But anyway, I progressively got worse and was relying on alcohol more and more. And, I was pretty much a full-blown alcoholic by the time 1994 came around. And that was the crisis point for me. I was so ill that my organs started shutting down, and a friend came to visit with me, and he took one look at me and he said, "You're totally yellow." My skin had gone yellow and my eyes were yellow, and it was the way the alcohol poisoned your system, and that's the physical result of that. So he immediately put me in his car and said, "I'm taking you to hospital." So he did that, and he dropped me at the emergency section of one of the West hospitals in Victoria, in just out of Melbourne. And I was reluctant to go in, but he sort of forced me into the emergency part, and a couple of nurses came out and took one look at me, and they threw me on a trolley, and that was it. I was in there for keeps. So they did some tests, and they said, "You're a very, very sick person. You'll be staying with us for some time." So, they put me in a hospital ward along with two other guys, and we were down the west end of the hospital, down near the end of the corridor, in this room near the elevator, the service elevator, and I didn't realise the significance of that at the time, but I did within a couple of days. It's where they put the people in the ward where they don't expect them to make it, because then if they pass away during the night, they don't have to put them on a trolley and wheel them past all the other patients. They just go straight into that elevator and down you go. So the guys that I was in with were both... the other guy in the bed next to me was an alcoholic, and the other guy in the bed across from me, he was he'd been overusing drugs. He obviously had an addiction to drugs as well. So anyway, that first night I was there, I woke up the next morning, and the guy in the bed next to me was missing, and I asked where he was because we started up a conversation the previous night. And they told me that he passed away during the night, and quickly followed by the other guy the next night. He died the next night. So it was myself left in this ward, and that was a pretty scary situation. I started to realise that I was a lot sicker than I thought I was, and it was quite obvious they didn't expect me to make it out of there. So... I remember that particular evening, as I was lying there in that bed alone, and they brought in my, I guess you guys call it supper, we call it tea or dinner, but I figured that might be my last meal. And at this particular time of my life, I wasn't a spiritual person in any way. I probably didn't even believe in God at that stage of my life. And... I remember eating that meal, and then I remember all this anger rising up inside of me. And as I lay there, I became abusive. I started screaming out. I was in a rage. And I figured, well, if there was a God, I was going to let him have it, you know. So I can remember sort of lying there in that bed and abusing God, you know, and blaming him for the condition I was in.
That's usually right where he's got you, where he wants you.
Yeah, yeah. I found that out later. Yeah, so anyway, after that happened, I commanded God to do away with me there and then. I said, okay, get it over with, you know. And then I remember throwing myself back on the bed, and I don't know what happened after that. I guess I went to sleep. I'm not sure, but I do recall waking up, and all I could see was this light. It was just really bright. It was white and glowing, and I thought, the damn nurses in this hospital are inconsiderate. They won't let a man die, you know, in peace. They left the light on. So I physically remember getting out of bed and walking across to the wall to turn the light off, but the light was already off. So I thought, well, am I dreaming? What's happening here? So I recall walking back to the bed, and I don't know what possessed me, but I did a silly thing. I thought, well, I'm going to pinch myself to see if I'm awake, you know, which was pretty dumb, I guess, because if you were dreaming, it wouldn't make any sense to do that. But I remember doing that, and I thought, well, that hurt. I must be awake. So I hopped back into bed, and I thought, no, I don't know what's going on here. Maybe I'm just suffering, you know, illusions because of the alcohol has finally cooked my brain or whatever. So I remember laying, about to lie down, and then I sensed the presence of this person standing at the end of the bed. And I sat up and looked, and I could clearly see that there was this, an American Indian standing at the end of the bed. And it wasn't like a hazy vision. It was like a real person. And I remember looking at him, and he was bare-chested, and I guess he had some sort of, it looked like leather, I guess buckskins or whatever, on. And he had his hair braided, and he had an eagle feather tied hanging down on one side. And I looked at him, and I thought, how the hell did you get in a hospital like this? Dressed like that. And I said, well, who are you? What are you doing? How'd you get in here? And he just stared at me. And I thought, this guy is just obviously drunk and he's lost his way from a fancy dress party or something. But anyway, he just stared at me. And I remember reaching out trying to touch him. And I couldn't, no matter how far I reached on the bed, I couldn't touch him. And he just looked at me and he said, you don't have to die. They were the words he spoke to me. And I said, what? And then I remember jumping out of bed, and he was gone. Anyway, I walked out of the ward, and I looked down the corridor. I thought, where did that guy go? So I started walking down the corridor, and I guess it was wee small hours of the morning. I'm not sure of the time. But I remember looking for this guy and figuring, how could he get down the corridor so fast? And I walked past the nurse's station, and she caught my eye, and she said, Mr. Palmer, where are you going? And I said, I'm just going to the bathroom. She said, well, you know where it is. It's back the other way. I said, oh, okay. So I remember walking back there and just staring in the mirror and looking at myself and going, what the hell's going on? You know, and I couldn't work out what was happening. I just I remember going back to bed and sitting there and thinking about this. Was it real? Is it just an illusion? What's happening? Because I had no sense of anything. There was nothing in my realm of reality that allowed for spirit to be in my life, if that's what it was, you know. So I couldn't conceive of that. So I just put it out of my mind. I thought, well, you're hallucinating, you know. And I put it down to that, and obviously went back to sleep. And then the doctors were coming in. I was in there for several days, and the doctors came in and did all sorts of tests. And I just met my current wife, Judy. I'd only been with her about 6 months at that time, and I hadn't realized that she'd come in to visit. And the doctors had told her that you better get his things in order because he's probably got about 7 or 10 days and he won't be here. So, that was their prognosis for me at that time. So, going further on from that, I think much to the doctor's amazement, I started to improve. I was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. I remember them giving me, I was very bloated too with all this poison inside of me. I'd bloated up. I was sort of like the Goodyear blimp, you know, of a yellow colour. And anyway, they couldn't, the pills they gave me, the diuretics to make me go to the toilet to get the organs working and getting rid of fluid, did not work. So they actually had to physically shove a needle in my side of my stomach and suck all this stuff out. And I think that was probably the most painful thing I've ever undergone. Yeah, so from there, they let me out of the hospital after a couple of weeks, and they told me that I would have to be an outpatient, which means that I had to come back to the hospital like every week for a few months so that they could just do tests on me and measure everything and see how I was going. And the only thought I had when I was in there was to get out and go down to the hotel and have a drink, but that didn't happen. So after some time, I started to feel better within myself, and they let me go back home under the condition that I, report to them, every week, and so that they could conduct these tests and stuff. So it was after that they put me on this program. It was a volunteer program. They said for people that have so severely damaged their organs with alcohol, as you have done, there is a program available that lasts for 12 months. It involves us doing tests on you in a medical centre, and you come in there once a month, and we put you through a CT scan, which measures all your vital organs and the component and all the measurements that they take for that sort of stuff. And after 12 months, you may be eligible to go on this new program that they had, this new medication. So they said, you don't have to do this, it's just available. And I thought, okay, well, I might as well. I figured that somehow I'd scrape through and escape death there. So I agreed to go on this program. So they came out and picked me up that first month, and they took me into the medical center and they CT scanned me, and that was fine. And they gave me a meal and took me back home, and they said, well, you come back again next month and we'll scan you again. So everything was just going along smoothly. And personally, it was strange when I came out that the desire to drink had somehow gone. When I was in hospital, I did suffer all the physical repercussions of alcohol abuse, and I certainly had the DTs and hallucinations and all sorts of things going on with my body. For a couple of weeks there, I spilt most of my food. I couldn't really manage it. I wasn't the calmest person there. So anyway. The second time I went back, within 6 weeks, I went back for that second CT scan. And I went through that, and I was sitting on the end of the machine, and they said, okay, John, just get dressed. And I'm sitting on the end of the machine and putting my clothes back on, and then I could see these three guys with lab coats on through the window and clipboards making notes. One of the guys came out and he said, have you got anywhere you have to go shortly, John, or anything? I said, no, why? They said, we'd just like to run you through again, do another scan on you. I said, oh, is there something wrong? He said, oh, we just need to check something, that's all. I said, okay, because it took about 20 minutes to do this scan. They just lay you on this bed and you go under the scanner. So I took my clothes off again, laid down, and they did the scan. Got up and put my clothes on, and they went and did what they were doing, and then I noticed that the three of them came out, and there was a little round table in the corner, and there was four chairs there, and those three of them sat down, and they said, when you get dressed, just come on over here and sit down. I said, okay. So I did that and sat down, and they looked at me and they said, what have you been doing? And I I didn't know what they meant, you know. I said, what do you mean, what have I been doing? I haven't been drinking. And they said, no, that's okay. They said, has anything unusual happened to you? I said, no. And I thought about that Indian at the end of the bed, and I thought, well, I'm not going to tell him about that because they'll probably just put the straitjacket on me and think I'm crazy. So I reluctantly kept that a secret. And anyway, they said, are you taking any other supplements? Are you doing any other medication apart from what we're giving you? I said, no, I'm just sticking to the diet that they gave me, which was a lot of grains and stuff like that. And they said, nothing else. I said, no. Well, then they did the good news, bad news story. You know, they said, well, we've got some good news and we've got some bad news. I said, okay, well, give me the bad news. So they said, well, the bad news is you're not eligible to stay on this program for the 12 months, like we said. I said, oh, well, have I done something wrong? They said, no, it's nothing you've done wrong. I said, well, you know, what's the good news? So anyway, they said, when you went into the hospital, when your friend dropped you off there and they took those initial tests that they did on you, your liver function was 18%, okay, which was really, really poor, just ticking over. And they said, well, you're aware of that. I said, yeah, I remember someone saying that, you know, that's why my organs were failing and the kidneys had shut down completely. And they said, well, what we just did when we asked you to take that scan, that second scan, was to check the readings. And I said, oh, okay, so what's the deal? And they said, well, your liver function is now 98%. And I just looked at them. I said, well, is that good? And they all burst into laughter. And they said, it's like a newborn baby. It's amazing, you know. So that's why we're asking you, has anything unusual happened? And I said, no, again. And I said, well, how does that happen? How can that happen? And they said, we don't know how that can happen. I said, so you're telling me, and your years experience, you've never seen this thing happen before? And they said, no, definitely not. They said, all we know about the liver is it is the only organ in the body that can repair itself over time. And he said, I'm talking about a long time. He said, you'd been abusing your liver for, you know, probably 40 years. And I said, well, you know, I was at a loss. They said, we have no explanation for how that can happen because, so within 6 weeks, it's gone from 18% to 98%. And they all stood up and they said, we don't know what it is you're doing, John. And they all shook my hand and they said, we hope we never see you again. And out the door I went. So.
Well, that's a fine howdy-do. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that was it. So all that really did for me, Will, was raise a hell of a lot of questions. Because I thought, how the hell... How can that happen? If these guys haven't heard of that, you know, what's the deal here? So I went home and I told my current wife, Judy, the good news. And I said, what's going on? What's all this mean? And fortunately, my wife is of Romanian heritage. She's a gypsy lady. So anything esoteric or spiritual was right up her alley. She said, well, I don't know what's going on, but she said, because I told her about this Indian after some time, I wasn't going to tell anyone, but I ended up telling her. I said, you know, how can that happen? Was that a hallucination? What was that? Is it a message or what is it, you know? And she said, well, I don't know what it is, but she said, my advice to you is maybe you just better listen to that Indian. So, look, from then on, it was just, I just became... Like it showed up in that main reading, I'd love to know how things work. I've always been like that. So it sent me on a journey of discovery, you know, about myself, about healing, about, you know, is spirit real? I mean, was it a real thing? Did that really happen? Did I die? Did I come back? I don't know, you know. So as they say, when the student's ready, the teacher appears, and it was within a few short months that I was led to a place in country Victoria where they were having a spiritual gathering, and I'd never been to a spiritual gathering before, and it was the very first spiritual gathering of spiritual unity of the tribes, which I'm now president of, and yeah, that was my first experience of anything of a ceremonial nature, and I walked into that gathering with my wife, and I knew nothing about these things, and there was a bunch of Indians and some Maoris and some Aboriginal elders there, and they were able to sit and answer a lot of my questions that I had, and I had a million of them. Yeah.
What year was that, John?
That was 1999, was that first gathering. But it was 1994 when I had that that crisis, and leading up to that gathering, I'd started reading books and of esoteric nature and made inquiries about, you know, how people healed with hands, and yeah, it just started me on a journey of discovery. I just wanted to find out all I could about this stuff to understand what had happened to me. Yeah.
I'll bet. Wow.
Yeah, so that's where
that's
it all began.
Do you remember any facial features that Indian had?
Guy?
Was his face square, round?
Yeah, no, he was an obviously a native man. I don't know from what tribe it wasn't, although I've done some work with you know, people over here. It could have been Cheyenne or Lakota, I guess, by the facial features and the way he was dressed, I guess. But, yeah, he sort of had an ageless face, you know. He wasn't an old man. He was probably, I guess if I'd have to put an age on it, he would be a middle-aged, you know, native person.
Well.
And he had, you know, he had long hair, and I think he might have had a bit of a braid on one side, but I do remember the eagle feather tied on one side, hanging down near his face. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, I had a similar experience in 85. And I didn't know till 96 who it was. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And found out in 95 that it was Mad Bear Anderson, because I'd never seen a. I knew who he was. Rolling Thunder was my teacher, and I knew who he was, but I didn't see a picture of him until I actually saw the book that was written about him, and I went, "Oh my gosh, that's him!" You know. And then I found out I'm not the only person that Mad Bear appeared to. Right after he passed away, and he appeared in Marcy and Quenzer and asked her to do a series of art depicting stories that have to do with the Great Law. So and I got a phone call from Tom. I never have told anybody about this, but I got a phone call in my sleep from Tom Brown Jr.'s teacher, Stalking Wolf.
Strange.
I lived in the middle of nowhere in this 22 miles south of Moab, Utah. I mean,
they're talking
about the Bear's Ears National Monument, and it was I could see it from there.
Yep.
And it was just some property that a mining company had developed, and there was a gas station there, and a mobile home, and a restaurant, and anyway, I dreamt that that the phone was ringing in the gas station, which I thought was weird because it'd been disconnected years ago, and I picked up the phone, and I said, "Hello," and he says, "I want you to stay right there at that corner until I come for you," and I said, "Who is this?" And he says, "Stalking Wolf."
Oh my God!
Well, I wasn't able to stay there, you know, I've more or less in the corner, and that was really something. And wow, yeah, it's really interesting. Some things that can happen once you get on the red road, and you know, some visions like the white path. And, so your wife is the Rome.
Yeah, she
which
is.
Yeah, so she would have. They know, and it's in their bloodline. And that's right. And so how long have you been in the States?
We flew in on the 28th of May, and we're here right through to the 23rd of August.
Sturgis, huh?
Yep, we're up in Sturgis, and yeah, we didn't come for the rally. I come for ceremony.
Ah. And
yeah,
so
we...
are you here for Sundance?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a friend that's that danced quite a bit at Crow Dogs, and he's very open to he's very open to people. You wouldn't think there'd be some racism, but a 6'6" red haired, blue eyed friend of mine, Lenape descent, wanted to Sundance, so he went down to Rocky Ridge, which is the Sundance the Navajos run, and Crow Dog was the head chief there, but the other chiefs are really giving him a hard time and stealing his pipe and, you know, just misdirecting him, just really being jerks. So he was there with a Bear Clan Navajo elder, and Crow Dog said, "Hey, look, you know these guys don't get it, and you're welcome to come up to where I am," and so they did. And this family, they spent 2 weekends out of 4 or 5 dancing at powwows in the Southwest, and dedicated to it. And good people, but he kind of felt like he got a little revenge, not personally. There was some Japanese guys there, and he happened around their camp, and they were cooking something that smelled pretty good, and some of the Sundance chiefs they had just had a bowl of it, and the Japanese guys he said, what is that? What kind of meat is that? And they didn't speak real good English. They just took their fingers and 4 fingers and went like they were walking on the ground and they'd kill the coyote. and if the Navajos had known they'd eaten coyote, they would still be vomiting.
Would they ever? Oh my god!
Yeah, that's a Navajo thing. Yeah, so he thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, that's
great. It's funny, isn't it?
Sure is.
But where are you guys going from here? You know, with spiritual unity of the tribes, and I do have your link up here, right on the on the page, so people can go there.
Ah, great! That's great. Yeah, we had our first gathering, as I said before, in 1999, and that was my first experience there, and the people that that hosted that, our good friends Don O'Connor and Sue Hewitt, they were the ones that brought spiritual unity of the tribes to Australia, and sadly they passed last year. They were killed in a road accident, and my wife and I had been working, helping them doing spiritual unity of the tribes ever since 1999. So they've gone on to the spirit world, and I always made a promise to my brother Don that if anything happened to either of us, that the other one would carry on spiritual unity of the tribe. So here I am. So that's sort of how it all started. And we've had 19 gatherings now over there in Australia, and our 20th one is coming up. There'll be information on our website, but it'll be April next year. Up on the border of New South Wales and Victoria, just prior to coming over here, 2 weeks before, we'd been up speaking with the Aboriginal elders up there who'd called for the gathering, and we just sat down and had a bit of a talk with those guys and made sure they were happy with us. They'd been wanting to have a gathering for a long time, but the wrong people were going there to try and put the thing together for many years, and they wanted it done in a good way. So after meeting with them, apparently we've got the seal of approval to help them do it. So we're very happy about that. So,
well, have you ever met a guy named Dave White?
Dave White.
Dave
no,
White. Yeah.
Can't recall it off the top of my head.
An old grandfather. He's lived off the grid and in the bush for 25 years. He's an old friend of Red Elk. He was an Olympic standard pistol shooter and ex-community radio presenter and ex-Royal Australian Navy communicator. And he's get along and you know, hangs around, goes on walkabout, and not sure where he lives. He's like customizing an old slide-in camper and about to go walkabout north to escape winter and visit a sister in Queensland. But sure and let him know. He's always listening, so he's always, you know.
Oh,
he's
that's
with
right.
It
he's
and,
probably.
But I'll be sure and.
That's great.
And also hook you up with him. And we've tried over the years to try to get an Abbo Elder on. It's hard with the telephone connection. And maybe if Skype gets better, you know, we can do that.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, a lot of the traditional elders still live in fairly remote places, you know. So, that can be a problem. But I didn't know whether you're aware that spiritual unity of the tribes actually started there here in the U.S. It was a result of a Tlingit, Alaskan Tlingit elder Jim Walton, and. Jim was a man who he was the chief of the Wolf Clan for the Tlingit people, and spiritual unity. He was the founding member of it here in the United States. There were problems on the reservation with drugs and alcohol and stuff, you know, and Jim wanted to see how that they could. Address these problems, and he spoke with a lot of the medicine people over here, and he ended up going down and talking to the relatives of Black Elk. He wanted to find out information about that vision, you know, and whether that vision was true. He wanted to sit and talk and find out, and so as a result of that, he went down and he found out that yes, you know, the way it was translated was correct, and so Jim went back and. He spoke with a lot of the medicine people, and he garnered a few spiritual leaders, got together. There was Ben Rodd from down here in South Dakota was another one, and Harvey Iron Eagle. They put this spiritual unity of the tribes together and held the first gathering was held in, I think, in 1988 in Saskatchewan. Was the very first spiritual unity of the tribes gathering over here. Since then, there have been many over here. They've had them up in Alaska and plenty down in New Mexico. The first one in Lower 48 was down at Nambe Pueblo in New Mexico with Grandfather Ernie Mirabal hosting that one. And, they've been all over since then. And as I said before, my brother Don was coming over to these way back in 1993, I think he came over for his first one, and it was one of the gatherings in Alaska that Jim Walton said to Don, you need to take this to Australia. So that was when Don and his partner Sue brought the whole thing over to Australia. So, yeah, and then we kicked off our first one in 99. As I said.
And that's so he started doing that actually before you had your near-death experience.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it sure
isn't that something?
When
so
you look back at all the connections,
how are things,
and it's
go
like,
ahead, go ahead.
Wow. Yeah, you look back at all the things that had to happen to make the connections, and it just blows you away, doesn't it? You know, I mean, you couldn't plan it that way, so you just sit back and let the creator take control.
How do you think public in Australia? I mean. Since, you know, Rabbit Proof Fence came out and other things, you know, motion pictures and other social pressures, how are things going down there? Because there's still quite a bit of racism in Canada. You hear about once in a while and here too and everywhere. But what do you think?
Yeah, look, racism against the Aboriginal people in Australia was, been really, it's really out there in the public. But I think a turning point for us was back about 8 years ago when our Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, at the time, unfortunately he didn't stay there too long, but he did a great thing while he was in there. The Aboriginal people had been trying to get an apology from the Australian government for what they call the stolen children. And, they forcibly removed kids from Aboriginal homes, since they got here, since the place was settled. They've been doing that, and no government has ever stood up and apologised for that hurt and the trauma that's been inflicted on all those families through generations after generation. But Rudd said if he got elected, he was going to issue a public apology, a national apology to the Aboriginal people. And as I say, that happened about 8 years ago, and I think that turned things around a lot because it was a beautiful thing to see. It was broadcast live all over Australia, and they had massive turnouts in all the cities where Aboriginal people and white people walked hand in hand across the Sydney Harbour Bridge and hugged each other, and it was like,
wow.
The emotion of that.
Wow. And reconciliation. And what year was that?
That was a yes, absolutely. We weren't in Sydney, but we did a reconciliation in the town we were in Ballarat. We just met with the Aboriginal people there, and so that was a turning point. There are still pockets of racism everywhere, not just against the Aboriginal people, but that certainly did change things and brought awareness to a lot of Australians. And if there's you even hear about it reported on the news that people are making racist remarks against other people on trains or buses. There's other people standing up now saying, hey, that's not appropriate. And, they're actually, stopping that sort of thing. So we're headed in the right direction, but we aren't home yet. Yeah.
Of course, Paul Hogan, he got started in there early with his movies and Aboriginal culture, and in case you don't remember that music at the beginning, that was his theme music. So
yes.
I thought that'd be apropos.
Absolutely.
And, I'm glad to hear that because those people.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
They're amazing and Quigley Down Under other things have gotten people to think about them. And I guess there's an old biblical belief that at one time all the continents were together. And it's really interesting because the North Carolina, which would have been abutted with northwestern Africa, has exact same kind of soil. And and of course that's totally different from just over the mountain here, but I understand that they've actually found Aboriginal DNA down around Tierra del Fuego, which would have been where it would have abutted with Australia. It's been several years since I heard that account.
Yeah,
but it's just amazing. Well, Rolling Thunder said it 30 years ago when I started on the Red Road, he says, before you die, he said, everything you've ever been told about Native Americans, it will be a complete overturning, and spading up I'm at a loss for words, but it certainly happened, and it's a sight to behold. And I could have died some time back, and really probably should be. And
me too.
Because so a few of us apparently are walking the earth by the grace of Creator, and we just, you know, and we're, you know, I'm sure you'll agree, you know, we're human too. We're not immune to things like
totally.
As you get older, you know, regrets and depression, but you got to stay focused on what you're here for. And
that's right.
I hit 60 about 3 years ago. I really started feeling my age, but you know, then this younger guy, Mac Boogaloo, comes along and breathes new life into this thing, and I worked with him for several years and never even met. I just met him last August. You know what?
Oh, really?
He's a Swedish German extraction guy. He's from Minnesota too. You know, it's got a lot.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, he's a great guy, man.
Iowa.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's really, really something.
Yep,
but,
sure is.
Well, we don't want to keep you too long unless you want to get to some things. But
that's fine. I'm very happy to have been able to share that. Well. It's been very enjoyable. Great talking with you.
Oh, and Mark, you got any thoughts?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you got any thoughts?
No. I just listening and what he had to say there about his experiences, and
you'll
probably find out
really
a little
something.
Bit more here and. About his Indian visitor.
Oh yeah,
I'm sure. I'm sure he was keeping tabs on him for a while. So,
I think you're right, Mark. I think he was watching over me, but I certainly wasn't aware of it until that moment.
Yeah, one thing you can do is that may help you is just kind of visualize him again, like especially right before you go to sleep.
Yep. Yep.
Just think about him and think about his face and what he looked like, and just ask for some additional help or guidance or input or whatever, you know, some clarification or something for you. Say, hey, you know, I kind of want to know more what's going on. You might get some more input that way.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll certainly do that.
Yep, and always have a good question to ask.
Listen,
folks.
Absolutely.
It's been another week, and we'll see everybody next week. And thanks again, John.
No problem. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much. Bye for now.
Good night, everybody.
Fair dinkum.
Good night.
And have a good trip home and a good ceremony. Good night.
Certainly will. Thank you. Bye.
Hi friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you have been listening to our program for long, then you know that Mark the Badger Borcherding does a Mayan birth reading for each of our interview guests. Mark suggested that he give away a free reading for each donation of $20 or more to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a ministry of Oklahoma Native American Church or the White Roots of Peace. So please support Prophecy Keepers Radio by making your free will offering at nativeamericanchurch.us. And you'll receive this gift reading. If you choose to make a recurring donation, once you've received your own reading, you can give readings away as free gifts. So why not head over to nativeamericanchurch.us and make an offering right now. Hope to be talking with you soon. Bye now.
Friends, this is Will Blue Otter, encouraging you to obtain an authorized participant or AP card and become a federally recognized Native religious practitioner. Presently, Aqua Native American Church is the only Native American church spiritually blessed by the Rosebud Reservation Native American Church and has a certificate of existence in the state of Utah that is authorized to worship on or off tribal grounds and has met the standard of sincerity and vow of poverty standards in the state of Utah and federal courts. This card is designed to assist all people regardless of their racial makeup, political affiliation, social and or financial status, and receiving their constitutional rights. This card is also designed to assist United States judicial officials to honor their solemn oath to protect and exercise the principles of the United States Constitution while carrying out their duty and serving their fellow citizens. To join the movement that is strengthening and exercising the principles of the United States Constitution, please obtain your AP card by visiting NativeAmericanChurch.us today.
Dry ground, sagebrush and mesquite and chaparral around, out away is a big dust devil moving on its way. I guess they're never still. In a sacred manner I live, to the heavens I gaze. In a sacred manner I live. My horses are many. The high grass and the cedar, the mighty oak and the tiny flower, the sandstone and the valley. Mountains high